Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart & Shipley, supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. And from Lewis, Longman & Walker, a Florida law firm helping clients navigate the maze of regulatory and political processes, offices in Tallahassee and statewide. More about Lewis, Longman & Walker's legislative lobbying and other governmental affairs practices is at llw-law.com. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
Florida A&M Police Chief Terrence Calloway joined protesters today on the steps of Florida's historic old capitol to oppose a so-called guns on campus bill.
I'm worried about an environment where there is constant suspicion. You don't know who has a gun, whether that person has been properly trained to handle a gun, or whether a person can be trusted with a gun.
Also tonight, the Florida Senate's proposal to expand Medicaid may not fly with the federal government.
Things like work requirements is one that they've expressed as being a no-go area.
We'll also get a preview of tomorrow's Florida cabinet meeting, along with a push to tighten oversight on the state's sober houses, as well as the Uber ride service. It's the start of week two of the 2015 Florida legislative session. I'm Tom Flanagan, and this is Capitol Report. Angry students and a grieving parent unloaded today on Florida lawmakers who want to make it legal to carry concealed weapons on college campuses. As Jim Ash reports, the father of a 20-year-old University of California shooting victim warned more students would die.
Last May 23rd, six people were killed and 14 injured. One 22-year-old Elliot Oliver Robinson shot up a crowded street adjacent to the Santa Barbara campus of the University of California. Robinson, who was mentally ill, took his own life. One of the dead was 20-year-old Christopher Ross Michaels Martinez. His father was filled with indignation Monday as he climbed the steps of the old Capitol to protest a so-called guns on campus bill.
I can't accept that my son died in this way. It was a preventable and senseless death.
Martinez, a 61-year-old criminal defense attorney, has been on a crusade ever since. Prevention and some grassroots lobbying drove him to Tallahassee during the second week of the legislative session. No one can convince him that more guns are the answer to spree killings.
It's just a fantasy to think that a civilian is going to be able to respond as effectively as a trained law enforcement person in these kinds of situations, and it actually makes the job of the law enforcement more difficult.
Senate Bill 176 by Greg Evers, a Republican from Baker, bans colleges and universities from prohibiting concealed weapons on campus. If the bill passes, Florida would join nine other states with similar laws. Evers declined comment. It's a common argument that guns don't mix well on campuses where alcohol, drugs, and depression are rampant. And Florida A&M Police Chief Terrence Calloway, who joined the protest, has another concern.
I'm worried about an environment where there is constant suspicion. You don't know who has a gun, whether that person has been properly trained to handle a gun, or whether a person can be trusted with a gun.
Supporters of the legislation are sympathetic to the survivors, but see them in a different light. Eric Friday is general counsel for the pro-gun group Florida Carry. He says each death is a reason to allow potential victims to defend themselves. Campus gun bans are useless because enforcement is so lax, he says.
Because criminals go where they know they will have easy targets.
If gun opponents don't believe in the deterrent effect of concealed weapons, all they have to do is ask the criminals, Friday says. In FBI surveys of prison inmates, one reason for avoiding potential targets rises to the top, Friday says.
It's not police officers. It's not the eventual punishment or being caught. It's coming across an armed victim because those armed victims fight back.
Evers' opponents have their work cut out for them. Evers' bill passed his criminal justice committee 3-2 last month. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Jim Ash.
Florida's small business marketplace is in for major changes under the Senate's Medicaid expansion proposal. Lynn Hatter reports after a slow start getting up and running, Florida Health Choices could see its customer base grow exponentially under the Senate's plan.
Last week, Senate leaders opened the door to using federal funds to support more than 800,000 uninsured Floridians. Now lawmakers in that chamber have a plan, but it's not quite what some proponents of a Medicaid expansion expected.
A lot of the conversation that took place last week around a proposal is not what this proposal is.
Karen Woodall is the executive director of the Florida Center for Fiscal and Economic Policy. The proposal crafted by the Senate Health Policy Committee is a change from one the Senate crafted 2 years ago. The original plan, informally dubbed Negron Care after its sponsor and crafter, Senator Joe Negron, would have used the Florida Healthy Kids program as a vehicle to funnel the Medicaid expansion population into private health plans using federal money. That plan, noted State Medicaid Director Justin Senior in a recent meeting, was one the federal government may have approved if it had passed.
When it came to Senator Negron's plan, they did feel, having looked at it, that it was approvable, as I recall.
But the House killed it, and the conversation has been stalled until now. The Senate is back with a new and different plan. This time, Florida Healthy Kids would fall under a different entity. The state's current marketplace system, Florida Health Choices, would become the new Florida Health Insurance Affordability Exchange. It would offer vouchers to people between 22 and 100% of the federal poverty level to make insurance purchases, and it would charge premiums ranging between $3 and $25 based on income. It also mandates work requirements, something supported by Jacksonville Senator Aaron Bean.
We hear so many people that people are working Floridians that just need a little a hand up, not a handout. So the work requirements, skin in the game, I think is very important that you pay a little bit. Everybody else pays a little bit. When I go to the doctor, I have to pay a little bit. And I think that's important.
Florida Health Choices was created in 2008 by the state legislature to promote competition and transparency in the health insurance market and bring down prices for small businesses. Health Choices looks similar to the health insurance exchanges that the federal health overhaul says every state must create, but it predates the Affordable Care Act by 2 years, and the state has worked to keep the two separate. It became functional last year. Today, Health Choices is selling ACA-compliant health plans but cannot tap into the federal subsidies, and its director, Rose Knapp, says it only has about 4 dozen enrollees.
Setting the headlines aside about the low enrollment, it went what I would consider as perfectly. It was a soft launch. We were only advertising in 3 areas. We saw the population targets did respond to our advertising. The majority of people were our target audience of those who are not eligible for subsidies in the federal exchange.
Two other groups, a coalition of small businesses and health providers called Healthy Florida Works and the Florida Chamber of Commerce, have put forth plans. The Senate's effort is buoyed by the impending loss of $2 billion in federal money, coupled with Indiana's recent success in getting federal approval for a Medicaid expansion plan with similar components. But the proposal, as written, could run into problems with the federal government. Justin Senior, the state's Medicaid director, told lawmakers the federal government has drawn no-go zones when it comes to certain payment issues.
Things like work requirements is one that they've expressed as being a no-go area. And there is also, I think, a real reluctance to impose cost sharing on people that live below the poverty line.
Still, the Florida Center's Karen Woodall says she's encouraged because, while imperfect, the bill is a start.
It's keeping the conversation going, and that's very important, and I don't want to minimize that.
The Senate will unveil its plan Tuesday. There is no House companion. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
As an outgrowth of questions about whether lobbying firms have accurately filed compensation reports, 26 firms were randomly selected this week for audits. State law requires lobbying firms to file quarterly reports that list their clients and give at least ranges of payment amounts from those clients, but some lobbyists questioned whether firms were providing accurate information. That spurred the Joint Legislative Auditing Committee to move forward with random audits. Of the firms selected this week, 14 will face audits of their compensation reports related to lobbying the legislature, while 12 will face audits of their compensation reports related to lobbying the executive branch. Join the conversation. Follow us on Twitter at FPRCapReport. Still to come on Capitol Report, the Florida Cabinet meets tomorrow. Will this be the meeting during which members come up with performance measures for the agency heads that report to them?
The framework for deciding when and how agency heads are removed or reviewed is definitely in the works.
Florida boasts a booming addiction recovery industry, but some say the state's sober homes need more oversight.
If they do a good job in the recovery residents, these people, these human beings, these beautiful kids have a chance to get better. If not, they can die.
And there's a renewed push in the Florida legislature to subject app-based ride services like Uber to more regulation.
The 90% issue in the world of Uber is the issue of insurance, background checks, and vehicle inspections.
Support for Capitol Report is provided by the Able Trust, helping businesses to hire workers with disabilities. Information about the benefits of hiring people with a wide range of disabilities is available at abletrust.org or 850-224-4493. The Able Trust. Empowerment. Education. Employment.
Florida Public Radio's Nick Evans joins us on a topic that we started visiting back here before the first of the year. It had to do with some rumblings about a now former Florida Department of Law Enforcement Commissioner, a gentleman by the name of Jerry Bailey, who no longer has that job, Nick. We had a cabinet meeting in February where this was supposed to have been a pretty hefty issue, but did not turn into one. And now we have a March cabinet meeting coming up. What is likely to occur there? Anything?
Well, I guess the first thing to do would be to step back to the February cabinet meeting. At the beginning of the meeting, Scott addressed the controversy. Scott acknowledged that the departure for Jerry Bailey was mishandled, but he did defend his actions.
In the private sector, there are no lifetime jobs. In successful companies, no worker is immune from regular performance reviews that determine whether they are meeting clearly defined objectives. State government should be no different.
So what Scott is proposing is yearly reviews where any cabinet member can bring a motion to remove directors. This wasn't properly noticed, though, so there wasn't a vote.
There's another angle on this too, Nick, as I recall, and that was that cabinet aides had done a lot of the groundwork for the ouster of Commissioner Bailey with perhaps not the full knowledge of the people to whom they reported, members of the Florida cabinet. So now I understand that the cabinet aides are meeting in the open and that their meetings are actually now being broadcast on the Florida Channel.
They are. And actually, at the last ones, we had the next step in this process. So Scott's aides showed up with specific metrics. But some of the aides for other cabinet members felt that this was putting the cart before the horse. Robert Tornillo said that we need to solidify the process before we start discussing metrics. He's with CFO Atwater.
How do you think that we could, at the same time we're approving a process, bring performance measures? I just don't know how that's going to work. And I don't think that's the intent of what, at least what I took away from the cabinet meeting that in Tampa.
Now, the other thing that we should talk about with the plan that Scott's aides showed up with, it's based on long-range plans for all three of the agencies involved, but it drops emphasis in some pretty important places. With regard to OIR, it completely removes a goal to protect the public from illegal or unethical insurance products. So the agency head in the future for OIR wouldn't be judged on whether or not they had protected the public from illegal or unethical insurance products. Similarly, with the Office of Financial Regulation, the goal to enforce compliance with state laws related to the financial industry is gone. But that being said, the governor has added in goals that are probably pretty predictable. Each one of the three agencies gets a new emphasis on whether or not they grow Florida's economy.
With all of these imponderables floating around then, Nick, what is likely to happen at the cabinet meeting for March?
Well, the cabinet members are going to see a plan that the governor has proposed. Whether or not they will vote on the metrics that he laid out is unclear, but the framework for deciding when and how agency heads are removed or reviewed is definitely in the works.
And we'll be following the process every step of the way, and we'll be talking with you about it as that occurs. Florida Public Radio's Nick Evans. Thanks so much, Nick.
Thanks.
Here's something related to what we just spoke to Nick Evans about. An open government advocacy group this week requested that a special prosecutor be appointed to investigate the circumstances surrounding the ouster of former Florida Department of Law Enforcement Commissioner Gerald Bailey. Barbara Peterson, president of the First Amendment Foundation, wrote an open letter to Governor Rick Scott and cabinet members that cited Leon County State Attorney Willie Meigs' decision not to investigate the matter. Earlier this month, the foundation also asked Attorney General Pam Bondi to appoint a prosecutor from outside Leon County to conduct an investigation, something Bondi said she didn't have the authority to do. The requests stem, at least in part, from questions about whether open meeting laws were violated in discussions about Bailey's removal back in December. Media organizations and open government advocates also have filed a lawsuit alleging violations of the Sunshine Law. Florida is home to more than 1,000 addiction treatment centers, with a growing number aimed at turning a profit. Along with those facilities come sober homes, and Regan McCarthy reports that's a part of the industry some say is lacking oversight.
A sober home is a place where a person can stay while fighting an addiction. At its most basic level, it's a home where all inhabitants support each other in their recovery and where drugs and alcohol aren't welcome.
The individuals that are living together with you in that space are on the same mission, and they're encountering the same kind of challenges in life that can cause barriers to sustained recovery.
John Lehman is the president of the Florida Association of Recovery Residences. His group, also called FAR, certifies recovery residences, but
there is no methodology that has been brought in place as yet that calls for these programs to actually adhere to standards.
Lehman says that's especially problematic for families or parents trying to help their loved ones while living out of state. Let's say Wisconsin, for example.
Yes, exactly. So mom is in Wisconsin. What does she know? All she knows is that there are some very good treatment programs in Florida, that the program that she initially enrolled her daughter in up in Wisconsin said, we think she needs additional care, and we're recommending that she go down to so-and-so in Florida for that additional care. So they file that recommendation, and they're sending their daughter down to Florida to be enrolled in a Florida model treatment center for 30, 45, 60 days, however long their insurance will cover that.
But after spending time at the Florida facility, Lehman says the insurance company would likely say it's time for the daughter to start getting outpatient care instead.
So now daughter needs to move out, and she needs to move out to someplace in Florida because she's going to continue her continuum of care at that intensive outpatient program. So where's she going to live? So now mom and dad need to start researching a quality recovery residence for daughter to live in. And where do they go to do that? Right now, they go to the internet and they just search in Google, and everybody's website looks like they're just fantastic.
But Delray Beach rental housing inspector and retired law enforcement officer Mark Woods says he knows from experience that's not always the case.
I had a registered sex offender who was the manager of a sober house with 20 girls in it. There's nothing wrong with it. There's nothing I could do or say to prevent that.
Woods says he regularly sees bad actors taking advantage of what he calls a vulnerable population. Representative Bill Hager has a bill aimed at addressing that. The Delray Beach Republican is filing a measure that would create a voluntary certification program for sober homes. Hager says the programs must meet certain standards to get certified.
Requires a level 2 background screening for all owners, directors, and CFOs, and that's designed to equal the screening that's currently in place for licensed substance abuse providers.
The measure is limited to providing voluntary certification because of federal laws protecting the homes of people with disabilities. But officials say it will help families better compare places where their loved ones could stay while recovering. Under the bill, a list of certified homes would be published on the Department of Children and Families website. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
twin bills floating through Florida's legislature would make it easier for immigrant children to receive health care. As D.A. Robin reports, expanding kid care for Florida children would cost just under $5 million.
Leroy Carter is a recent immigrant to the U.S. About a month ago, he tried and failed to get health insurance for his child who is here. Carter says he makes too much as a part-time worker to qualify for some health care. But his problem is also that he just arrived.
And then the fact that I am a green card holder who has been in the country for less than 5 years, it has put some restrictions on what care I can get.
Proposed changes to the state's kid care rules could help people such as Carter insure their children. Republican Senator Rene Garcia's kid care bill is simple. It lifts the 5-year wait for legally residing immigrant children to get health care. An identical bill is moving through the House. Garcia says his bill in its current form would only affect children who are in the state legally.
It's taken some time to try to educate some of our members that this has nothing to do really with immigration, but it has to do with quality health care for children, for legally residing children.
He says, however, he favors expanding free health care to all the state's children, immigration status notwithstanding.
I believe that children, all children, should have access to health care and access to health insurance. They are here by no fault of their own, and they are children.
The Florida Conference of Catholic Bishops supports the bill. Associate Director for Health for the group, Michael McEwen, says bishops want to ensure children in the state are safe.
We're always out to protect vulnerable populations, and we believe that these young children are vulnerable if they're not receiving health care.
Democratic Senator Eleanor Sobel says she expects the bill to pass the Senate easily and says she hopes the House agrees to fund the measure. She says the bill's $5 million price tag is probably lower than the state would pay for uninsured hospital visits.
It costs much more if these kids would go to the emergency room. It would be maybe $40 million.
The bill would take effect on July 1st. For Florida Public Radio, I'm D.A. Robin.
You're listening to Capitol Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. The Florida legislature shifts back into high gear tomorrow, and Ronald J. Eben gives us a look at some of the major topics scheduled to come before lawmakers.
Tuesday will be a busy day for lawmakers. They'll be tackling some major pieces of legislation. The Senate Health Policy Committee will talk about Medicaid expansion. They'll consider a wide-ranging proposal that would set up a new health insurance exchange to help provide coverage to hundreds of thousands of low-income Floridians. The Revenue Estimating Conference meets at 9 Tuesday to update general revenue projections. General revenue plays a critical role in funding schools, healthcare and prisons, and lawmakers will use the projections in drawing up a budget for the fiscal year if it starts the 1st of July. The House Higher Education and Workforce Subcommittee will consider a bill filed by Representative Neil Comby that would create a public records exemption for information about people applying to become president, provost, or deans of state universities or colleges. The Senate Commerce and Tourism Committee will take up a bill by Senator Jack Latvala and would make the president of Enterprise Florida subject to Senate confirmation. The Senate Criminal Justice Committee will consider a proposal filed by Senator Thad Altman that would require juries to be unanimous before recommending the death penalty for defendants in murder cases. The state cabinet also meets tomorrow. Governor Scott and the cabinet will discuss issues related to the appointment and review of agency heads. The issues stem from the controversy over the ouster of former Florida Department of Law Enforcement Commissioner Gerald Bailey. Those are some of the highlights on tomorrow's agenda. I'm Ronald J. Eben.
Finally tonight, the ride-hailing app Uber has been operating in Florida for the better part of the past year. This despite concerns over safety, insurance coverage, and the overall legality of the service. While a patchwork of regulation has begun to emerge on the local level, Florida Public Radio's Nathan Pemberton reports state lawmakers are eager to settle the issue once and for all.
All it took was a tap on the screen of my mobile phone to hail an Uber car. It arrived in about 15 minutes.
Hello. Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
The most valuable tech startup in the world does not want to be legally defined as a car service alongside taxis and limos.
I don't think most of the statutes ever contemplated their type of product. And so I think they really operate in a gray area in most areas. And so that's what we're trying to help clarify this year.
Uber's mobile app and business model is at the forefront of the ubiquitous sharing economy, one that lawmakers like Senator Jeff Brandis are attempting to regulate and define. He sponsored a regulation bill last year that failed to get through. He's back with a similar bill this year. Brandis says to ease the concerns of consumers, the legislation will place an emphasis on public safety.
The 90% issue in the world of Uber is the issue of insurance, background checks, and vehicle inspections. So that's really what our legislation focuses on, is those three areas.
Background checks and driving records free of DUIs will be required for all potential drivers. The bill would also standardize and increase auto insurance coverage for Uber drivers, but stop short of requiring the same type of insurance and regulations that taxis and limos have. Uber expanded its presence this past summer to cities throughout Florida, including Tallahassee, drawing the ire of cab companies, county commissions, and airports throughout the state. And Roger Chapin, spokesman of the Florida Taxi Cab Association, thinks regulating Uber in a category of its own is damaging to the taxi industry.
When we're buying a commercial liability insurance policy on our vehicle, when we're getting a permit, and we're paying a commercial lane fee, you know, it's unsustainable, that business model. It's actually the worst case scenario.
Chapin refutes Brandis's notion that Uber exists in any gray area. He says the companies blatantly define state taxi codes.
That's not intellectually honest. I mean, they simply refuse to be regulated, and the taxi cab industry is kind of caught in the middle.
And cities attempting to regulate the ride-hailing service could see their efforts undermined, should the proposal become law. The House version of the bill by Representative Matt Gaetz includes a preemption clause to override local regulations.
I am generally not in favor of the state's increasing approach at preemption and preventing local governments to govern their communities in the way that is most fitting for that community and in line with the expectations of their public.
That's Tallahassee Mayor Andrew Gillum. The city commission recently introduced an ordinance to regulate ride-sharing services just like any other car service, placing it under the city's taxi administrator. In a statement, Uber spokesman Taylor Bennett says, quote, "Categorizing Uber as a commercial carrier simply aligns us with the existing taxi code, which ignores ride-sharing's innovative business model. For now, Uber drivers like Dorothy will continue to use the service as a valuable point of income."
"Well, no, I'm not doing it full-time. It's the only thing I do."
The move will also affect other ride-sharing services like Lyft, and fans of the ever-growing sharing industry say regulation could also hinder other non-traditional services, like the private home rental app Airbnb, which hotels despise. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Nathan Pemberton.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Jim Ash, Sasha Cordner, Ronald J. Eben, Nick Evans, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, and Matthew Seeger. We also thank D.A. Robin, Nathan Pemberton, and our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at @FPRCapReport. And join us again each weeknight during the 2015 Florida lawmaking session for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows, at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: a grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley, supporting public radio and taking time to care, on the web at searcylaw.com. And from Lewis, Longman & Walker, a Florida law firm helping clients navigate the maze of regulatory and political processes, offices in Tallahassee and statewide. More about Lewis, Longman & Walker's legislative lobbying and other governmental affairs practices is at llw-law.com. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.